Harvest makes awesome software for tracking time, planning projects, sending invoices, and generally helping me keep it all together at work. Or at least look like I have it all together, even if I'm actually still wearing sweatpants. I love how easy it is to use, whether I'm working solo or scaling up a larger team for a big project. You'll love Harvest too. Go to getharvest.com to try it free. And if you're ready for a paid account, use code KNOWYOUGO to get 50% off your first month. That's getharvest.com, code KNOWYOUGO.
Hey friends, welcome to Know You Go, the show about being ambitious and sticking together. I'm Jen Lucas.
I'm Catel Ledoux.
And I'm Sarah Wachner-Betcher. And today we are talking to Tracy Chow, who is an entrepreneur and an engineer whose push for tech companies to start revealing employee diversity data back in 2013 kickstarted a lot of huge changes in Silicon Valley and put her on the cover of The Atlantic and Wired and a whole bunch of other stuff. It also led her to become a founding member of Project Include, which is a nonprofit that is on a mission to accelerate diversity and inclusion in the tech industry. So we chat with Tracy about how she became a diversity advocate, how that's changed her career, and what she's learned along the way. But before we do that, I just want to kind of check in with everyone. So how's life?
Life's been a little wild this week. We kicked off some really big team changes at work. You know, some small changes, some big changes, but like some people's day-to-day has got like pretty changed up. And of course, seating changes.
Oh gosh, that can be a big doozy. How's it going?
Well, I can say this. People really just don't care for change.
No,
not at all.
You know, I've been thinking a lot recently about like, why do people hate change so much?
Because we all have habits and comforts and then you take them away and it's very hard because inside we're all just delicate little flowers. Like seriously,
yeah, we are.
It's hard.
You get used to something and you're like, wait, now everything's changing and like, how am I going to adapt and how am I going to like deal with this? And I think, yeah, it can feel overwhelming. And especially when, you know, it has to do with like sort of changing folks that you're working with or, you know, places you're sitting. Like, I think physical changes can like impact you a lot.
And maybe also the thing with physical change, like where you're sitting, is that nobody really realizes it, that it's impacting them so much, right? Like people will underestimate how much of an impact that can have. And so it's the kind of change that can really affect your day to day, but that nobody's kind of taking stock of. And it's sort of assumed that that'll just be fine. And I think that those changes are hard, right? The ones that we don't invest enough time in like planning for and understanding that there's like an emotional component to it. The other thing I think about when it comes to change is that like, oftentimes people will know that the company needs to change and they'll complain even, right? That like about the way it's organized and it's so hard to get anything done and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yet when you try to enact changes, it's really difficult to get people on board. And I think part of that is also like change that people are choosing for themselves versus change that is being done to them. And like the reality is nobody likes to feel like there's something being done to them. And so that's one of the biggest things I always think about is like, how do you make this something that people feel a little bit included in or consulted on, or at least how can you put it into terms that will help them, you know, see it as something that's going to help them in their day to day or like take away some of the pain that they were experiencing in terms of like workflow or whatever. And of course, that's not always invested in. And it's also not always true. Like for some people, it's not actually solving the personal problems they had, even if it's solving company problems. And then it's like, okay, how do you get people on board and sort of get them through that hard part of shifting gears?
One of the things that we do with team changes that I think is really good is reestablish team norms. So sit down with everyone and everyone sort of discusses, you know, just like what are like the routines and what are the beliefs and the things that are important to people as a team. And I think that can really be helpful with new teammates to be like, here are things that are important to me. Like, what are things that are important to you? And like, what's it going to be like to live together at work?
Yeah.
Do you have any sort of particular structure for doing something like that?
We have like the scrum masters run that and sort of they have like a questionnaire list that like brings stuff up. So people eating lunch at their desks or like how you use the shared space or like the table. So like we, you know, like I said, we switched teams. So we had to discuss, hey, can we still use this table to watch Jeopardy at lunch?
Very important.
Yeah. Bullet point number one, Jeopardy.
Right. But I mean, also things like how you point stories. So like pointing stories is basically a level of effort of like how much an effort will take to get some sort of feature work done or something at work. We do daily stand-up at work where people like tell you what your status are in meetings. You know, what time is that? Or are you doing them over Slack or like virtual stand-ups? I think it can also be things like, here's how I receive feedback best. Or, you know, here's how I think we should handle reviews of other people's work.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many questions that come up when there's any kind of change like that. Since I don't work in a company, but like the kind of consulting I do with companies is always about change because invariably they are coming to me because they realize that their content and their user experience like isn't working as they want it to. And the reason that it's not working is always rooted in they're not being like able to make it work as a company, right? The way that they're organized, the way they do things, who's in charge of what. So I have to talk to people about how their jobs are going to change and how things are going to be different. And I'm a big fan of having people practice some of those skills. So if it's like, okay, we are going to do a different kind of writing process where instead of, you know, you produce this content over here in this department and then you ship it out the door to send it to this other department, there's going to be a collaborative process. Well, then, okay, we should practice that. And so we'll do that in a workshop setting where we'll pair people up and we'll actually practice like, how do we work on these things together? How do we share drafts and get feedback from each other? And I think that those kinds of like low stakes practice sessions, because you're not doing your real job, you're just kind of practicing the new thing in a short period of time. I think that that can help people feel more comfortable with talking to people they aren't used to talking with.
Yeah, I mean, and I also think that it lets you feel more in control. And sometimes if you embrace that, like if you know change is coming, you can do more exercises like that and sort of prepare and be ready for this. So if you are expecting change, like, or just like knowing it can happen or knowing specifics, you can just like be better ready, I think, to deal with it.
I love thinking about kind of how a different perspective or like sort of embracing, you know, a different kind of approach to the change can kind of help you through it. Like it makes me think of when I was at National Geographic, we would go through organization changes from time to time. But at a certain point, we actually went through a really big physical change where we went from everyone was in cubicles and not just cubes that were like low, sort of like where you can see everyone. It was like 6 feet tall and offices, and everyone went to cubes that were like 4 feet high. So everybody could see everybody, you know, including managers. It was all sorts of like all different levels, and people were really freaked out. And one thing that we realized like immediately was going from sort of a perceived sense of privacy to not having any meant that like we kind of had to think about the workplace etiquette a little differently. And just like no one had thought about that. Like no one. It wasn't, you know, a matter of like management doing something wrong or like folks, you know, not thinking about it. It just was like, oh, wait, we have to work together a little bit differently. And something like I've actually seen work really well is at a co-working space I go to here in Philly. Someone made these little coasters that were like red light, green light. So basically you put your little like green circle up if you were ready to chat to people or like, you know, didn't mind having people come up to your desk, or you put the red one up if you were like, I'm going to be heads down and working on something. So I don't know. I just think this idea of kind of like looking at things a little differently too can help.
It's like Fogo de Chão. The Brazilian steakhouse where green means like bring me more meat and red means like no, I've had enough. Yeah. I mean, I really like that because like, you know, we used to say like the universal sign was headphones, but I think we all know that doesn't work. I was reading a bit on like, you know, Harvard Business Review about this. And they had some like interesting things about like finding humor in the situation, talk about problems more than feelings, don't stress out about stressing out, focus on your values more than your fears. You know, this idea that like remembering that you're you no matter what the change is can like really help you. The change doesn't have to define who you are. But something else I really liked was this like don't expect stability, where they talk about this 70s research that was done where they studied two groups of managers and like one group thrived and the other didn't. And they said, you know, the adaptive leaders chose to like view all changes as an expected part of a human experience rather than as a tragic anomaly that victimizes unlucky people.
Yeah.
And then the struggling leaders were ones who were consumed by thoughts of quote unquote the good old days and they spent their energy trying to figure out why their luck had suddenly turned sour, you know, because they kept looking back to something that wasn't there anymore.
That's so interesting, too, because like that just reminds me so much of politics, right? Like you have so many people who are talking about the good old days and you're like, wait, when were the good old days and for whom exactly? And I think it's true at work, too, where it's like when people get obsessed with the good old days, those are probably also mythical, right? Like they may have been good for some people in the organization, but it's undoubtedly that they weren't working for other people.
And the other thing that you might like, if you dig in, you might be like, okay, well, this part was good, but this part wasn't. And like, you can think about how to get that good part back. So like, if what you missed was that like you sat with someone like, or you worked with someone really closely that you didn't, you know, like make sure you're setting up like time for lunch with them, or maybe you set up pairing sessions where you still work together, but you know, trying to figure out like what it is that you did like, and then what are things that you can apply moving on? Like, what are the things you're excited about now? And what are the things maybe that you didn't really like then? And like, maybe you didn't get a chance to like work on like these exciting things or work with this person. And now you do get to work with this new person, or you do get to work on this new project, or like maybe this new seat allowed you to like clear off the desk that you've been meaning to do. It's like funny. I was actually like, in the seating change, I ended up not moving seats. And I'm like, oh, but I've got all these boxes I got to break down.
You're like, no, I need like a move to help me reorganize.
Yeah. So just like, you know, like you're saying, like trying to figure out like really like what are the positives moving forward? If there are things you will miss from those days, how do you like keep them up and like try to make the best going forward as much as you can? I mean, it's always hard and I don't want to make it ever sound like that's easy, but I think we can all do it.
So we've been talking a lot about change, and our interviewee today definitely talks a lot about change in the tech industry as well. So I'd like to get to that interview, but before we do, we have one last little segment. It is brand new. It is called Time Trivia, because we talk about time on this show like all the time. We need more time. We try to balance the time we have. We, you know, rant about how we're sometimes feeling a little bit unbalanced. And so our friends at Harvest wanted to see if we could stump each other when it comes to time. So let's see. Cattell, you're up today. And our theme is women authors. Are you ready?
Oh, gosh. Let's do it.
Okay, Cattell, here's your first question. J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter manuscript was rejected 12 times before it sold for an advance of only £1,500. Now she sold more than 400 million copies. How long did it take her to write that manuscript? A, 5,000 hours. B, 15,000 hours. Or C, 50,000 hours.
Oh my gosh, this is already a lot of numbers. I'm going to say C, 50,000 hours.
Cattell, that is correct.
Yay.
It took her 6 years to write Harry Potter.
That's a lot of hours.
We even tried to stump you with the 12 times, £1,500, 400 million copies. You were unstumpable. Question two, more math, sorry. Emily Bronte published Wuthering Heights under the pseudonym Ellis Bell in 1847. If she'd been paid a freelance rate of $50 an hour, pretty good in 1847, how much would she have earned for her wild, passionate tale of Catherine and Heathcliff's love?
Ugh, I love this book.
Is it A, $740,000? B, $60,000, or C, $330,000.
Oh my gosh. I'm going to go with B, $60,000, even though I feel like it should be more.
It is way more. It is actually $330,000 because it took her 9 months to write that book, which is still like a real short time considering how great that book is. Ugh.
Yeah, it is. I'm glad that it was more than 60K.
Okay, Cattell, last question. Stephanie Meyer's classic tale of vampire love and lust, yes, Twilight, has become a 5-film series. If Stephanie had been billing her time to clients instead, how many 15-minute increments would she have billed? A, 870, B, 8,700, or C, 87,000?
Ooh, 8,700?
Cattell, you know your 15-minute increments. That is correct. B, 8,700.
2 out of 3, not bad. I think that's a winning score. So thank you so much to Harvest for sponsoring our time trivia today and for supporting women authors, which they do, and women podcasters. So check them out at getharvest.com. Tracy Chow is a wildly talented software engineer who's also become a leading voice in tech industry diversity and inclusion conversations. She has been an engineer at Quora and Pinterest, an advisor to the U.S. Digital Service, and is one of the co-founders of an organization I'm personally super fond of, and that's Project Include. She was named to Forbes' 30 Under 30 tech list in 2014, and she has been profiled in everything from Vogue to Mother Jones. So I am extremely excited to welcome Tracy to the show today. So you went to Stanford, you interned at Facebook, you were one of the first engineers at Quora, and one of the first engineers at Pinterest. That is kind of like a perfect Silicon Valley pedigree to a lot of people. Except you've also written about feeling out of place during a lot of that time and not necessarily feeling like the industry was designed for you. And I'm wondering if we can start there. Like, what was it like in the beginning of your career and what was exciting about it and maybe what was not so great about it?
Yeah, so I grew up in the Bay Area surrounded by tech, and I think that made it very easy for me to naturally fall into the tech industry. When I started working in tech, I think I just accepted things for the way they were, including the lack of gender diversity, racial diversity. I honestly didn't notice or think that things should be different. But there definitely were experiences I had when I started working that felt off, and I didn't know how to articulate or pinpoint them. I tended to blame myself or think that there was something wrong with me when I had a lot of coworkers hitting on me all the time, for example, when I was interning. And, you know, when I started working and felt like I might be treated differently, I assumed that it was because I wasn't as qualified or there was something about the way that I was approaching my work that was inferior and therefore caused people to treat me differently. So it took a while for me to put all the pieces together. And some of that was just talking to a lot of other people in industry, other female engineers. One of my early conversations that really started to make me aware of these sorts of issues systemically was with Tristan Walker, who is an African-American founder. And he had reached out to say that he had seen some of my writing about being female in engineering and wanted to share that he had similar experiences, even though he wasn't technical and he wasn't a woman. Being the only Black person in the room oftentimes felt as alienating, and he could really identify with a lot of things that I was saying. And that helped me to see how pervasive the sort of experience of marginalization is, even though the tech industry is one that tries to pride itself on being so innovative and designing the future, being this engine of progress. There are so many ways in which it is still very backwards.
What years were that? That was like 2010, 11, 12 in there that you were really kind of getting going in your career and having those experiences?
Yeah, the first sort of Silicon Valley tech internship I had was in 2007, but I started working full-time in 2010.
So in 2013, you wrote this post on Medium that got kind of a lot of attention, where you were calling out the lack of data about women who are working in tech and maybe specifically working in engineering, and the lack of success metrics attached to companies' diversity efforts. So like if companies maybe had diversity efforts, they didn't necessarily have any sense of whether they were working or not. And so that post kind of blew up, and a lot of companies started sharing their numbers in a GitHub repo. And for listeners who aren't familiar with GitHub repos, it's just a site where you can work collaboratively, usually on software projects, but you can also do things like collaboratively share data. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about like how that happened. Like first up, like what made you sit down and write that blog post? And did it feel risky when you did it?
I had been working in industry for a few years at that point, and had gotten to know a number of the female engineers at other companies. And it started to be this thing that I would keep track of the back of my head, like which startups, which companies had which female engineers. Whenever I went into rooms, I would automatically start counting. So it was just something that I was keeping tabs on personally. At the same time, I was looking at diversity at Pinterest, and I wanted to make recommendations to the team about what we should do to be more diverse and inclusive. Facebook and Google were getting a lot of really good press around their parental leave policies, for example, and lots of companies were talking about how they were sending lots of people to the Grace Hopper Conference, which is this big annual conference of women in computing. But I found it very hard to justify recommending any of those things to Pinterest because there were no success metrics. So these kind of thoughts were swirling around in my head when I went to Grace Hopper that year. This was October 2013, and I was at a breakfast where Sheryl Sandberg was speaking in front of the room, and she made a comment about how the numbers of women in tech were dropping precipitously. which I didn't disagree with the sentiment of, but it made me wonder what numbers she was talking about, because to my knowledge, there were no numbers really out there. And so when I got home with all these thoughts rolling around my head, I ended up writing this post around diversity data. I was also reflecting on how the way we treated workforce issues was so different than the way we treated product development. As an engineer, I'm so used to having to have data for everything. And we're pretty religious about tracking all this data on our users and understanding their behavior. And that's the way that we approach problem solving in product development. But the lack of data on the workforce side just felt so hypocritical to me. It seemed like it wasn't really a problem that we wanted to solve if we weren't even looking at the data. And of course, I understood all the reasons why companies were skittish about even tracking the data, because it would also mean that they would start to acknowledge the problem and have to solve it. But when I wrote the post, I wasn't expecting much of a response. I didn't think that it would be something that many people would even read, much less act on. I would also add, though, that in hindsight, it seems like this post became big immediately and started this whole movement. But it did take some time as well. It was more of a slow snowball effect. So there are smaller companies that contributed their data first, and the bigger companies took a little bit more time to process and work through what they wanted to do before they all started releasing their reports as well.
When I look back on it, it kind of reminds me of, in some ways, like the moment that happened last year when Susan Fowler published her Uber blog post, where there was this moment like the table had already been set for this conversation and it was just, it pushed it over the edge or something. And I'm not sure if it's exactly the same by any means, but it did really feel like a moment was happening. And I'm curious, why do you think it ended up really snowballing? Like, what was it about that moment that you think caught on?
I think there was general appetite to do something about diversity and inclusion. More people were acknowledging that it was a problem. And I think the way that I framed it, which was, let's just start sharing some data, made the problem seem a little bit more tractable. At least there was a first step that people could take. There was one thing that an individual contributor, for example, could do. So if you're working at a small startup, you could look around the room and see how many engineers and how many female engineers and count that up and submit that data into the repository. And it felt easy, actionable, and also clear that this would contribute to a broader cause. I think I had a little bit more credibility as an engineer working at a company that a lot of people knew. And I think that that piece is still important. I could speak from the perspective of being on the inside. And I think also just got lucky. In a lot of ways, I think of this project as like a startup, where startups have the markets that they're going after, the product that they're trying to build. Sometimes they're too early and the market isn't ready for them. Sometimes the product isn't just quite right yet for people to want to engage with it. But a lot of things have to come together all at once, and a lot of timing, all of that plays in. And somehow this Medium post that I wrote and the GitHub repository that I set up happened to be just right at that time to capitalize on this increasing intent from people in the community to do something. And I think I was the right person, the right time to be pushing on that message.
Mm-hmm. If you're an engineer or anybody who uses GitHub already, it's also like, it feels sort of like a natural place or a more comfortable place.
Yeah, I think the GitHub angle was also interesting because it spoke more to engineers and people who write code, as opposed to HR. So it was getting engineers submitting their data through pull requests. And those people are less encumbered by thinking through, like, what are the legal ramifications or what are the HR risks here? They're just thinking through, like, this is the team that I work on. I want to report the data on the team.
This is so fascinating to me too, because in that post in 2013, you also focused really narrowly on defining the technical roles. Like, you wanted companies to talk about actual engineers, not every other role, not business development or whatever, sort of as a way of saying companies shouldn't pad their numbers about the women they hire if women aren't in those roles. And I see that point. I'm also curious if that perspective has shifted over the past few years or, you know, or changed at all.
One of the reasons why I wanted to be very specific about just tracking women in engineering was that for something that was crowdsourced, it had to be as simple as possible for people to contribute that data. The more you ask from people, the more you drop off you get in that flow. So I wanted to make it super simple. But the other point about just looking at engineering versus the rest of it was that I did want to get away from that sort of padding of the numbers. And in the tech industry, engineers are very much valued because we are the ones building the products that are being sold. I'm very close to the core value of the companies. So there's this idea of looking at where the prestige is and how much inclusion you have there. Now that there's more data coming out, we can see that even if you have a reasonable amount of representation across the companies, usually they're lower ranked, fewer of those people are in decision-making roles. One interesting data point that I would love to see that is very hard to get is diversity on the cap table. And so that's looking at ownership of the company, like who owns the shares. And I would suspect that ownership in these different tech companies skews very heavily white and male, because founders will have a lot of stock, early employees will have much more because the stock grants are risk adjusted. So people who are joining early will get much more stock. Investors get stock, executives get a lot of stock. So even if your company has a lot of women, but they're all in the lower ranked non-technical roles, the value that they get out of the company doing well is much less. So I really wanted to dig in on engineering within tech because that is like so close to the core of Silicon Valley.
One thing I'd love to ask about, you know, we talked with Nicole Sanchez of Via Consulting back in June, and her company focuses, you know, on diversity and inclusion in tech and consults with a lot of tech companies. And one of the things she said to us was that she flat out does not love the way that the numbers are being reported by tech companies right now, that there's still a lot of gaming of the system because so much of the numbers is like just about percentage of people in full and percentage of new hires, right? And that there's not a lot of information about things like retention of those employees and seniority of those employees. And as you mentioned, who is actually getting a cut of these companies, right? Like who's really taking home money? And so it sounds like, and I'm curious about your thoughts on this, but it sounds like, you know, the way that you were initially looking at some of these metrics was sort of really, really important at the time, but maybe isn't quite enough to answer the questions that we have about how that industry is doing and to answer the questions that we have about whether things are getting better.
Absolutely. I think we need much more comprehensive metrics. And there is certainly gamification of the current metrics that get released. I think getting people even into the flow of releasing any data was a pretty big step. And I think it's good to keep pushing on companies to release better data. So one obvious thing is like intersectionality. So instead of just putting out gender on one side and race on one side, like looking at those intersectional cuts and just see like, is it just white men and white women getting promoted? How does it look for women of color? Like those sorts of questions can't be answered if all the data is being split out. I've been relatively heartened by how much companies have been willing to release, like enough that we can look at their data and see that in the last few years, even if we made some progress on gender diversity, we've had backsliding on racial diversity, which is not a good statement on the industry, but at least we have that data that we can even point that out and see that some of these diversity efforts aren't uniformly benefiting different people and in fact are causing some harm to different groups.
So another thing I was really hoping to dig into that I think you kind of touched on a little bit when, you know, you're kind of talking about technical versus non-technical roles is I'm also curious how you feel about who's considered technical in Silicon Valley and sort of the valuing of engineers when you are also kind of thinking about sort of the appreciation for what it takes to build tech products. I was reading an article you wrote, I think last year, about realizing that it's not really just about engineering and realizing the value of learning things like understanding people and human behavior and, you know, communication skills and, you know, liberal arts and humanities and the stuff that you hadn't necessarily taken that seriously when you were in college as something that was important for ensuring that the things we're making aren't, I don't know, laced with bias or harmful to people and being able to think through sort of the impact of our work. And so I'm curious how you think about those things together. Like, okay, you know, we value technical roles a lot. And so it's important to look at who are in the roles that we value the most, but are there also issues around the kinds of roles that are valued or the kinds of roles that even exist? And like, how do we sort of make sense of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think our whole way of approaching technology building right now is pretty flawed. I think for a long time, we've unquestioningly assumed that technology is always progress. So whatever we do in the software realm will be positive. And we're seeing very clearly now that that's not the case. Like, it's very easy for these software products that we're building to be used for harm or used in ways that we didn't anticipate. And for the people who are building these products, whether it's the engineers writing the code or everyone else involved, like, we do need to think more holistically and broadly and contextualize our work in society and understand what the impacts of technology are before we can assume that we're doing good. Some people have drawn analogies after the election cycles in the last couple of years to the sorts of ethics considerations that other domains have had. So chemical engineering or in physics, when the people in those fields realized that their work could be used to create weapons, they had to think pretty hard about doing science or doing this kind of research. And I think the people in the tech industry and software right now really need to have that same sort of introspection and deep questioning. For a long time in the tech industry, we've really downplayed the value of humanities education. And I think that is problematic. You see that reflected in compensation, for example, like who gets, you know, these big payouts, who gets really big salaries. It's tricky because also the sorts of value that someone who can bring in terms of the ethical reasoning and product guidance, that work is not as easy to value, put a dollar amount on. It's a little bit easier to look at what an engineer is producing or a designer is producing and say, this is the value of their work. And it ties very directly to the final output. And I think if the whole system is fundamentally shifted around, and we can start to see the value that non-technical folks are bringing, then hopefully that is reflected in the compensation and payouts as well. At the same time, you have just like very classic supply and demand type issues around sorts of talent that you need. So I think engineering salaries will be high for a while because engineering is very obviously needed and there aren't enough engineers to fill all the roles. Even if we were to recognize the value of the non-technical work that needs to be done, if there's such a mismatch in supply and demand on the technical side, the salaries will still be higher there. So there's a lot of things to address systemically, but I think one starting point, even just within the companies that we're looking at, is trying to shift the culture to acknowledge the different viewpoints that different people from different educational backgrounds and different training can bring.
I think one of the things that's also like interesting and maybe compounds all of this is the way that a lot of the kinds of roles that are more based in humanities or social sciences or that would benefit from that kind of background, they are tending to have a lot more representation of women in them. And so then you kind of have this interesting cross section of like the skills are in less demand. Also, we're used to paying women less, or we're used to putting women into sort of more caring roles versus, I don't know, rational roles. And so it's hard to tease out all of those different issues that intertwine and result in gendering of who's in what kinds of roles and devaluing of some roles. And then also to have the conversation about, well, why is it that so many women are in these kinds of roles and not in these other kinds of roles? And to like be able to talk about all those things at the same time, I think is really hard for a lot of people. Like it takes a lot of investment in the discussion to be able to like pick apart things with that level of nuance. And like, I think a lot of the time, like organizations aren't there yet.
Yeah, I completely agree. There has been some research into when professions become more lucrative and prestigious, how the men tend to crowd the women out. So there used to be more women in software engineering and they were kind of pushed out. So the 37% of CS degrees in 1984 went to women, and it's been declining. The percentage has been declining since then. But in other industries as well, one that I found kind of interesting was beer making used to be mostly women, and then men found out that beer making was cool, and then it became all male brewmasters. Even in things like cooking, when men reach the top and become these top chefs. It's very prestigious, even though women still do most of the cooking around the world. It's just not viewed as prestigious or lucrative for them. So as you were saying, there's all these interesting dynamics at play, and it's really hard to tease out specific effects.
Yeah, totally. You know, I think about some of the conversations I've had with folks when like startups started hiring people to do, quote, growth hacking. And we're like, wait a second. Isn't that marketing? I think they're doing marketing. But marketing was always more women in the field, and growth hacking was like this very like hardcore bro kind of role. If anybody out there is a growth hacker is their title, I'm sorry if I'm making fun of your profession. But it's one of these like kind of made up titles that's almost, I think, like masculinized a lot of skill sets that were traditionally perceived as being more feminine. And then lo and behold, those people are being paid a lot more money.
I think you also see this reflected in the maker movement, where it's been rebranded as like this very male type of thing where you're like making things. But if you actually look at what is being done, like creating things from like the raw materials, like that's stuff that a lot of women have been doing in different domains, but it had to get rebranded for men to be super into it and for it to become prestigious.
Totally. Like what's not being a maker about like being a knitter? You're literally making things out of thread, right?
Yeah.
I'm amazed that we have not gotten to this yet because it's so important. I want to talk about it. Okay. We have not talked about Project Include. So you started doing all of this work to share this data that you were gathering and to talk about this issue. Can you tell us a little bit about how that grew into founding Project Include?
Project Include was 8 of us, women in tech, getting together a couple of years ago. So there's a lot of discussion in the broader sphere about the problems and everything that was going wrong, but not nearly enough about solutions. And for the people that wanted to do the right thing, they still didn't know what to do. So we thought that the highest leverage thing we could do is write down our recommendations and resources, what we knew to be best practice around implementing diversity and inclusion. Our initial launch was just a website with a lot of recommendations of everything from defining culture, to implementing culture, to doing training, hiring, resolving conflict, measuring progress, and also like a framework to think about all those things. So it's not just like pick and choose some of these tactics and apply them to your org and then you'll be fine, but thinking through more holistically how to approach diversity and inclusion truly inclusively. So it's not just gender or just race or just one facet of diversity, and then being very intentional about measuring progress. So there's a bunch of these recommendations we wrote down. The feedback we got from the community was really positive, and people wanted us to do more with it, which is how we ended up incorporating as a nonprofit and adding Startup Include as a program where we actually work with cohorts of companies on implementing these recommendations. But our hope is really to drive these solutions forward, and we're focused on startups for now. We think that the highest leverage opportunity is with startups before they become too big and are hard to steer, try to get those good practices and processes in early. And hopefully some of these startups that are thinking about D&I early will end up becoming the big companies of tomorrow. They'll already have baked in these best practices. We also acknowledge that what we think to be best practice now may change. And so we really do want to build more of a community around these issues and solutions, and kind of the same way that open source software works, where you put stuff out there, everyone can benefit from it. As they're using it, they may think of ways to extend it or improve on it, and they're contributing that back to the community. We want that sort of a community around diversity and inclusion.
That's really interesting. And I think it's one thing to identify problems. It's one thing to try to address them, but like, we clearly don't really know how to fix this yet. So I'm curious, is there anything that you've found as you've been advising Project Include and sort of seeing it grow and adapt? Is there anything that you've seen out there that you've really feel like you've been able to learn from and that's like helped to shape where you're making recommendations now?
The biggest takeaways still are that you need metrics to understand where the opportunities are, and also where things are going well. So we recommend that all companies do look at their data. It's cool to see so many people trying out different things. I think it will take some amount of time before we learn which things really work in a long-term sustainable way. But definitely excited to see lots of people experimenting with D&I now.
So Project Include, that was founded in 2016, right? So you've got a couple of years of kind of starting to shape the organization and provide more than just, you know, your manifesto, but also the actual community and practices and working with these companies. So I'm excited to see what else comes out of that.
Yeah, one thing we've been thinking a lot more about is how to achieve leveraged impact across the industry. And some of that is going to be working with other organizations. Earlier this year, a couple of us launched this project called Moving Forward to get venture capital firms to, first of all, have anti-harassment policies and then publish them, make them available to founders, and then also have points of contact as accountability. And so this came out of some of the Me Too harassment stuff that came out last year, where what we saw was that in that relationship between founders who are trying to raise money and venture capitalists that control this money, there's this gray zone of interaction where they're not necessarily in a professional relationship yet. As in cases where there is a power imbalance, sometimes there are abuses of that power. So our idea was to push venture capital firms to be very explicit about what's acceptable behavior between people that work at the firm and potential founders that they might want to be investing in or other people in the community. And so we launched Moving Forward, now have over 100 firms that have their anti-harassment policies out there and the points of contact. But this is something where I worked on that separate to Project Include, but we ended up realizing that there was a good opportunity for collaboration between Project Include and Moving Forward, so I could serve as a little bit of that bridge.
That's so cool. Sounds like you just have your hands into like so many different parts of this problem and like trying to sort of untie the knot from lots of different angles, which I really love.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to be done here. So lots of opportunity.
That is so true. I feel like we've been talking a lot about your work as a diversity advocate. And I just want to like go back to you for a minute, because I saw you write a while ago that you don't want to just work on diversity issues because you love to code and you like your life a lot more with that in it. How do you balance those things and stay excited about both?
I still identify as a software engineer and someone that likes to build products and build things. Sometimes that means building teams and companies, but the diversity and inclusion piece will, I think, always be a part of my life. And that conversation is still just so prominent in the industry. It's hard to not take part of it. So they'll always be a part of what I do, but in my more like full-time capacity, I do like to be thinking just about technology, how powerful it is, and how it can be used to hopefully impact the world for better.
I'm also curious, you know, if the move from San Francisco to New York has had any impact.
So many things change all at once. It's hard to say. I do think being in New York has helped to broaden my perspectives quite a bit. I'm not surrounded by tech people all the time. And I like being around people who don't think about the same things I do all the time and just be surrounded by this greater diversity of people.
We talk a lot about place on the show because I feel like, you know, so many conversations in design or tech or publishing or whatever can be so like limited to such narrow places. And so I'm always interested in, you know, kinds of perspectives that people can bring in. So we are just about out of time. And before we go, I wanted to say, Tracy, I have been personally inspired by your work for a long time. And I know I'm not the only one. So I want to thank you for being on the show and ask you, is there anywhere that our listeners can better keep up with everything that you're up to?
The best place to keep up with me is Twitter. So I'm Trikatora on Twitter. It's T-R-I-K-E-T-O-R-A. I tweet a lot, so I also will not be offended if you follow and then unfollow because there's too much going on. But that's the best place to keep up with me.
Well, I know that a lot of our listeners will definitely want to hear everything you have to say, even if you tweet all day.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being on the show.
Hey, y'all. Time to talk careers with our friends at Shopify. This week, we've got a tip on what to look for in a company from Shannon Gallagher, a product manager on the merchant analytics team.
Being a lifelong learner is super important to me. I need to constantly grow and push my boundaries. The nice thing is, that's one of Shopify's core values too. When you make a positive impact here, you can move into new roles, new disciplines, and new spaces. That's had a huge impact on my career. 2 years ago, I was on the recruiting team. Now I'm in product management, and I'm still expanding my knowledge and reaching for new goals every day. This kind of environment means I'll never get bored or feel like I'm stuck in one place. The point is, You'll love work so much more if you're with a company where the goal is growth.
Thanks, Shannon. If you want to join a team where you can keep learning and make unexpected and wonderful moves if you want, then you should check out Shopify. They're growing globally and they might have the perfect role for you. See what's new this week at shopify.com/careers.
Okay, so I've got a fuck yeah this week, ladies.
Let's hear it.
Sutter and I are taking a vacation this week.
Fuck yeah!
I know. I mean, we could just stop there, mic drop. But this vacation is to Wildwood, New Jersey. And for those unaware that the magic that is Wildwood, it's a wonderful place at the Jersey Shore with boardwalk food and funnel cake and soft serve ice cream. And perhaps most importantly, it's only a bit over an hour from Philadelphia. And here's what we knew. We wanted some time to get away to ourselves, but we're not really in a place where we wanted to plan something big or get an off flight. We just wanted like some time with each other. And that's not because we don't love our son, but 2 years ago we took a baby moon when we gave ourselves like a long weekend before a major change in our family, and we're gonna have that again soon, so we wanted to do something like that. But how do you get that time to yourselves when you have a toddler? So we were like really thrown off, and honestly, like I was like, well, that's fine, we don't really have to do it, like, you know, not a big deal. But then this like wild idea came to us. Why don't we ask his parents if they're available to watch Cooper for 2 nights?
What do they say?
They said yes.
Yeah.
And so it's amazing what happens when you ask for help.
That's awesome. And also grandparents love to help in that way.
It's like, you know, I don't know why, but like asking for what you need can be such a hard hurdle to overcome, but it can totally pay off awesomely. So I am saying fuck yeah to asking for help.
That's awesome. This actually resonates with me too, because when I take time off at a book apart, I have to make a point of putting it on the calendar and asking folks to like cover some stuff while I'm out so that I don't have to worry about it or think about it, because otherwise I would never actually like really get time off. Like I have to actually set up that, you know, those boundaries and ask for help. And I didn't realize that until late in the game. And I was like, oh, I actually need to like raise my hand and do this so that I can properly take time off. So I love this.
I love this too, because it's actually a really good reminder for me, because I think, as both of you know, because you've called me on it before, I do not like to ask for help. And I sort of take it almost as like a point of pride to like do it all myself. And that's been good for me in some ways, but everybody needs help, myself included. And it's one thing to ask for help, and it's also another thing to actually accept the help and like let go, right? Because part of what you're saying, Cattell, is when you set that boundary where you're like, okay, I'm taking a real vacation, can you please handle this for me? You're also saying, and I'm not going to check in, so I need to be confident that it's handled.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that that's something that's hard for me, is to just like to fully let go. And to just say, nope, this is handled and I'm not going to get all anxious about this. I'm just going to accept that it's handled. And I realize it's not a lack of trust. It's like I trust them, but it's almost like my brain doesn't trust me enough to fully let go. You know, I have to remind myself like, no. You asked for help. Now your job is to take the help and then walk away.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it is hard to do things like that, but I think it gets better with practice. I mean, you know, I read a bunch like last year, like some like manager books, and, you know, they talk a lot about like just delegating things and delegating tasks and how important that is. But what's really important is like when you delegate the tasks to trust that they're going to get done, and then like be okay with the fact that whoever does them will probably veer from the way you're going to do it. So like we left an agenda or notes of like what like Coop's normal day is for the grandparents, and not to be like, you have to do it this way, but just so they have like a guide-ish, like, here's what we would do. But I understand if you're not going to do it exactly the same way. And you know what? That's okay. I'm okay with that. Thank you for the help. I'm going to be able to now focus on other things that are like more important than making sure that you did this exactly the way I would have done it.
Yeah, I think that is so true. I'm like thinking about this and I feel like we need to come up with an acronym like for all the parts. So like accept help, let go, enjoy, ill.
That's also what I would like to have on my next vacation.
Yeah, exactly. Well, fuck yeah to asking for help and to getting it. And we hope you enjoy.
Eat some funnel cake for me.
Okay. You got it.
Well, that is it for this week's episode of Know You Go, the show about being ambitious and sticking together. NYG is recorded in our home city of Philadelphia and is produced by Steph Colburn. Our theme music is by The Diaphone. Thank you so much to Tracy Chow for being on the show today. If you like what you've been hearing, thank you so much. You're the best. And you could be even more the best if you would take a moment to leave us a rating or review on your podcast listening app of choice and let your friends know about Know You Go, because we'd love to have them here too. We'll be back again next week.